and really speaks to the power of what the Global Labor Research Center has become and continues to develop in. The interdisciplinarity is obvious. The discussion today, which I think will be a very exciting discussion and certainly put everything off to a great start in the center, social science, sociology, Osgood, and sociology again. So there's more that kind of real clarity around the importance of diverse engagement with notions around global labor or labor generally. And then the roundtable discussion, which you'll all participate in, will be a really important piece of what goes on. And I think the time, the work that's being done here couldn't be timelier. The many forces, climate, displacement, automation, are converging to threaten livelihoods of individuals and groups across the globe in terms of their labor, in terms of so many aspects of their lives. Growing inequality, fractured social relations, and historical and ongoing structural violence provoke great rifts, often setting up fierce competition and conflict rather than cooperation and creativity. I think there are also provocations to draw us into cooperation and creativity, and maybe that's a big part of what a day like today can do, give us better ways to imagine the work that we do together. Responses are too often reactionary and fretful rather than forward-thinking and imaginative. Today's event does, I think, embody how York aspires through our research to better understand the human condition and the world around us, and to use the knowledge we gain in the service of society. And those are nice words. I think that there are, however, many researchers for whom those are words that they take to heart. We're deeply committed to advancing innovative research projects across the vast spectrum of disciplines, social, economic, cultural, and environmental well-being of society to foster those things. And more specifically, the work at the Global Labor Research Center aligns with our priorities and strategies for research intensification in the office of the BPRI. And I won't rehearse the strategic research plan with you, but I'll encourage you to have a look at it and see your place in the strategic research plan and think about the 5 research opportunities. These are things that the university has committed to, at least on paper, and they're worth paying attention to. They're worth, as you're applying for grants, you're thinking about your own work, showing how what you're doing is really part of a strategy that so many of us at the university are committed to. So, applause to Luann for this vision for the GLRC, for her work to enhance, expand, and mobilize diverse and inclusive community of scholars and practitioners to move, engage relevant and political research forward to critically examine and address the urgent issues that that were faced in the whole range of situations of labor, and particularly global labor. So a very good welcome to this day today, and thank you very much for this opportunity to talk. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And please join us as long as you
I
can stay.
I'm going to stay for a bit, and
okay.
Then I will have to leave. It won't be because I'm not interested.
So I'm going to stay seating. If everybody can hear me, is that okay? That way the panelists don't need to twist their necks to try to see me. I want to say a little bit to introduce the distinguished scholars from York who have agreed to talk with us today. You can't hear me? I should stand up?
No, I'm just a little louder.
A little louder? Okay. Maybe I will stand. I can stand here. So each of the scholars here have been invited to say a little bit about their research as it relates to one of the 5 themes of the Global Labor Research Center. So I will briefly introduce each one. I could say so much more about each person, but I do want to leave time for them to speak. So I will invite you to check out their profiles, learn more about the work that they do. Carlo Finelli is assistant professor and coordinator of the Work and Labor Studies program in the Department of Social Science. His research interests include work and labor market restructuring, public policy, political economy, and social inequality. He's the author of Megacity Malaise, Neoliberalism, Public Services, and Labor in Toronto, and co-editor with Brian Evans of The Public Sector in an Age of Austerity, Perspectives from Canada's Provinces and Territories. Carlo will speak about his work related to the theme of work, employment, and labor rights. Lewin Goldring is a professor of sociology at York. is affiliated with CERLAC, the Center for Refugee Studies, and the DLRC. She's co-editor with Patricia Landold of Producing and Negotiating Non-Citizenship Precarious Legal Status in Canada. She's the PI of a SHRC-funded project on citizenship and employment precarity. Her current research examines the relationship between non-citizen precarious legal status trajectories and pathways and social inequality. Lewin will address the theme of migration, citizenship, and work. Adrian Smith is currently the academic director and former student caseworker in the Poverty Law Intensive Program at Osgoode Hall, run out of Parkdale Community Legal Services. Prior to joining Osgoode in July 2018, he taught at Carleton in the Department of Law and Legal Studies and the Institute of Political Economy. His work addresses the legal regulation of labor in historical and contemporary contexts. Adrian will address the theme revitalization of workers' movements. And Pat Armstrong is professor of sociology at York. She's a PI of a 10-year SHRC-funded project called Reimagining Long-Term Residential Care, an International Study of Promising Practices, and also of Changing Place, Unpaid Work in Public Places, focusing on equity in the fields of social policy, women, work and health, and social services. She has published widely, co-authoring more than a dozen books and co-editing another dozen, as well as many journal articles, book chapters, and technical reports. Sadly, Faye Faraday, who was scheduled to be one of the five presenters today, is under the weather, so she's unable to join us. So Pat has kindly agreed to address two topics in her comments today, and I'll give her a little more time to do that. So she'll speak.
I'm glad you said that so people can
hear. Yeah. I'm being totally inequitable and offering Pat more time because she's going to speak about work and health, as well as gender relations in work and labor movements. So just to frame things very quickly, I'm not going to talk long. I want to introduce our discussion, and then I'll hand it over to our guest speakers for today. So I think about these issues a lot because I'm confronted with concerns or even anxiety and anger about work, employment, and livelihoods every day. In the classroom, from students who believe or hope that a degree, sometimes a second or a third degree, will lead to a job that will sustain them. I hear about this from my young adult children and their friends, many of whom have put their lives on hold until they can land that elusive, full-time, permanent job with benefits. I hear about it from my Syrian friends who struggle to support their families on a monthly welfare check that is woefully inadequate and long to make some sort of contribution to the community that welcomed them 3.5 years ago. And this, alongside reports of low unemployment rates, economic growth, these are measures that are disconnected from these day-to-day lives of people. And then our response. We hear, for example, from the provincial government rhetoric that is all about aligning high school and university curricula with the labor market to ensure that young people have monetizable skills and can, quote, transition from the journey of learning seamlessly into the workforce, unquote. As if the labor market is an autopoietic system, as if it is self-producing, self-maintaining, self-repairing, and somehow preordained, as if we are at the mercy of local and global economic systems that function autonomously beyond human control and interference. How do we respond to this vision of higher education and learning? To frame our discussion today, I propose that we consider the role of higher education and research, the work that we do here in the university. How do we respond and address these pressing issues? So following the presentation, I've invited each panelist to reflect on the following or some aspect of the following related questions. How might higher education encourage active and engaged leadership on these urgent challenges we face together? And how can research educators influence the direction of change in labor markets, labor movements, local and global policy, and so on? So each panelist will speak for about 10 minutes. I'll keep time, but I'm not going to be rigid. Following this the discussion. We'll talk until about 3. There will be a reception outside in the lounge area with food, and I invite you to hang around for a little bit, continue the conversation. So I'll hand it over to the panel. Carlo, do you want to start us off, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, yeah, there's one right here. I'll grab it.
You want help in here?
Thank you, Ms.
Okay. I will, while Paolo's just getting ready there, we have an attendance sheet. We invite you to put your name. This is names down, and if you'd like to be added to our listserv, please provide us with your email address. This is just for our records. We'd like to know who is here. It's important for us to keep track, so thank you.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank Luann and all of you, obviously, for coming and for inviting me and the rest of the GLRC. I'd also like to thank my co-panelists for letting me go first, because I'm certain that I would not be able to follow up on them. So I appreciate their kindness in that. I appreciate more than Luann's invitation to condense about a decade's worth of multiple overlapping projects into about 10 minutes' time. And I've tried to do that through 3 themes in my work. And, of course, here's a little comic strip just showing the different phases of research. But I think I've been fortunate in my own career thus far that I've been able to match some of my previous paid employment, principally working with the City of Toronto, some of the research that I've subsequently undertaken related to public finances and unionized workplaces. So the way I've divided my talk up, and I have 3 themes I'd like to talk about. The first is austerity, public sector work, and services. I'm going to try and do this in about 3 minutes. So if we close our eyes and think about the number of urban public services we rely on from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed, it's an astonishing array of services. If you think about it, most of us plug in our phones in the evening, we wake up. Some of us might go to the washroom, wash our faces, go to the toilet. So we rely on utilities and plumbing and water, to walking outside and walking down sidewalks that are maintained by municipalities, to stoplights, to police officers, ambulance, a whole array of public services that are often the area of municipal providers. So municipal urban public services have a very close relationship with those who produce it, in other words, the workers, and those who consume it, meaning the residents of these various communities. So if we think about Toronto, which is a city I've been focusing quite a bit of my work on over the last number of years, but after writing a book on Rob Ford, I decided I wasn't going to write about Toronto anymore. I was going to start writing about Ontario politics, and then Doug Ford got elected, so I'm not sure what I'm going to write about anymore, but I've subsequently moved to some other cities as well, Vancouver, Montreal, Winnipeg, and so forth. But if we think about the City of Toronto's annual operating budget, it's expected that by 2023 there will be an annual deficit of $1.42 billion operationally. Now, as many of us know, municipalities by legislation cannot run deficits. So this means that they have to find ways to close this gap every year, which usually results in kind of ad hoc, politically driven debating on council on what we're going to cut as opposed to how we're going to raise revenue, because municipalities are constitutionally constrained in how they can go about doing this. These problems are not unique to the City of Toronto. The province's municipalities face about a $60 billion worth infrastructure investment gap alone. This includes everything from drinking water to pumping stations to sewers, roads, and bridges. Whereas municipalities were once responsible for about 36% of our infrastructure, today that's more than 60%. And this has to do with the downloading of infrastructure responsibilities onto the provinces, which then shifted these onto municipalities. So, of course, this results in a context where pressures for municipalities to find cost savings have been growing. And the way they've tried to do this most pressingly over the last number of years is first off through the privatization of municipal assets on the one hand, and secondly through the contracting out or privatization of employment. And these have been really put forward as a means to restore budgets. Now, unsurprising to most in this room, these do absolutely nothing, if very little, to actually reduce budgets. But this is not what they were ever meant for. In other words, this was not the point. The evidence of outsourcing and privatization is hardly a panacea and will not solve the underlying fiscal constraints of municipalities that are at once constitutionally constrained because of 19th century realities that are better suited to the 19th century when municipalities weren't responsible for all the things they do today than the kind of urban realities today, the urban realities of today. So on this point, where to start and what do we do? So part of what I've been trying to do with a number of colleagues in this room and in other universities is reversing this manufactured fiscal crisis, right? And we argue it's manufactured because these are both legal constraints and political constraints. So one could be through new revenue tools, which could be through the reversals of cuts to personal and corporate tax cuts, which most benefited the wealthy, as well as reverse cuts to, for example, the GST, which we often don't talk about and are not talking about at all during this federal election. But of course, municipalities can resolve issues related to climate change, transportation, housing, wastewater at the local level alone. So this requires new intergovernmental planning capacities, which I think need to be put back on the agenda. Fortunately, the failure to address these concerns before it's too late might regrettably mean a kind of longer period of stagnation as poorly funded cities continue their economic polarization and decline, which folks like David Holchansky at UFT and others have been discussing for quite some time. Unfortunately, lest that be addressed of thinking Toronto is the center of the universe, these problems are not unique to the city here. Vancouver, Montreal, Winnipeg, these are all other cities I've written on as well, have kind of had similar problems and tried to resolve them in similar ways. So that's all I'm going to say about, I just want to say one thing, why I posted Local 79, which I was a former member of. If you take a quick look at this picture here, one of the things you'll see is that, I'll give you an indication of rather, Local 79, the 2009 municipal civic worker strike was the largest and longest municipal worker strike in Canadian history. And this is unique for a reason, because Local 79 is more than three quarters women and more than half representative of historically racialized groups. And part of the arguments that I've been making over a number of years is that this is not accidental that the city of Toronto, which subsequently became known as the Toronto model in terms of forcing their employees to take concessions, has been tried to be replicated across other cities. And I think this has implications because if we look at the 2009, 12, 15, and 18 contract negotiations, what we've seen and what I've subsequently argued is that this has been a road paved with concessions. New hires are paid at half the rate of previous hires, no job protection guarantees, no protection against technological displacement, and so forth. So this raises a series of questions that I think need addressing. So that's all I'm going to say about austerity, public sector workers and services, because we've tried, you know, some of the work I've been doing has been moving this into the provincial spheres and its relationship with the federal government as well. So next I want to talk about a theme that's been really present throughout my work, but we've been focusing more on recently, is low-wage work and its relationship to living wages. So in Canada, as we're familiar, there's been real wage erosion for some four decades. If we take inflation into account, the real value of minimum wages peaked sometimes in the mid-1970s. In 1976, average hourly earnings peaked at close to $24 per hour. Minimum wages as a percent of average industrial wages also peaked at a high of about 47%. And the reason we use average industrial wages was because, as a measure, is because historically this has been one of the sectors with higher union density. And of course, during that time, we've also seen major changes to the composition of union density. So we've seen real wage stagnation through this period. There's also a very uneven distribution of low-waged work. In Canada, or rather in Ontario, women account for some 60% of minimum wage earners. Approximately 55% are over the age of 25, so far from the stereotype of teenagers living in their parents' basements. Low-wage work is also notably racialized and getting older. We have a historically unique situation where entrants into the labor market and those who have exited are actually competing with low-wage and secure jobs. And of course, this has led to a broader gendering and racialization of poverty. Today, 10% of Canadians earn a minimum wage, and 20% earn below $15. So this project that I'm talking about comes out of a new project that my colleague Brian Evans and I, with a great group of scholars from around the country and internationally, put together in a new book that's coming out with UBC early in the new year that looks at living wages in comparative perspective. My own contribution to this, one of the chapters is looking at questions of media representations of minimum wage movements. And so part of the process we went through was asking, you know, are editorial boards supportive? Are they indifferent? Are they opposed to the policy goals of living wage movements? Do they challenge, do they reinforce mainstream neoliberal economic ideas, these ideological arguments? And how we did this was we identified 52 editorials published in 14 major daily newspapers in Canada between 2007 and 2017. So we looked at over a decade's worth of editorials. And you know, what were the editorial positions they took on proposed increases to minimum wages? We were surprised and not surprised to find that 72% of these editorials maintained were against it and maintained three things. The first was that they inevitably result in job losses and reduced hours of work. The second is that they only benefit younger workers dependent on their parents. And third, that they do little to alleviate working poverty. Of course, the unfortunate reality is that the evidence does not support these arguments. Not at all discussed were things like the fact that raising the wage floor counters weak demand, increases productivity, reduces after-tax redistribution, increases consumer purchasing power, there's higher employee retention rates, and that the fact that a majority of minimum wage workers are in firms with 500 workers or more, which means that these are the most profitable companies that are abusing these practices. So this is actually what's consistent with the actual data. So unfortunately, the editorials are not consistent with the actual data. And then finally, related to this is we tried to do a comparative overview internationally of how various locally based living wage movements have tried to deal with these challenges. And the four main approaches we found were voluntaristic or advocacy approaches. In Toronto, for example, this is led by groups like the CCPA or Living Wage Canada. Legislative approaches, trying to convince our politicians to change legislation. Business-led approaches, where businesses take the lead and get certification in some cases. And then, obviously, worker-led approaches. And they all come with their challenges and benefits. But they come out of a frustration with government's kind of ad hoc and conservative view of minimum wages as a floor rather than a higher standard based on need. It also speaks to the promises and perils of localized movements, especially in a geographically dispersed country such as Canada. Nevertheless, it is important as a heuristic device. But one of the big questions to come out of this project is this question of political fragility, which accompanies such a broad coalition and finds agreement on such a narrow ground. In other words, when the movement begins to push for more expansive coverage, it encounters both more vigorous opposition and threatens the integrity of the coalition. So the whole point here is to think about moving beyond kind of technocratic policy advocacy and starting to rethink political solutions. So that's all I want to say about that. And if I have 2 minutes left, 1 minute. 1 minute? Okay, sure, 1 minute. This one's quick. This is a project that I've spent a couple of years doing called Great Lakes Pirates. These pirates don't come to steal your gold on your boat. They come to steal your jobs. Basically what I did was I spent a couple of years, and this was actually fun, believe it or not, working on a charter fishing boat. And, you know, nothing better than the captains and first mates. Lights better than it's like, hey, professor, go clean the toilets, hey, professor, you know, which is great because it's a really humbling experience doing these kinds of things. But in any sense, this project basically looks at the Uberization of the Lake Ontario charter fishing industry. And I conducted 24 interviews over a six-month period with 8 charter vessel owners and operators. In other words, the boat captains and the first mates. It's a two-person operation. And the crux of the issue is this. Three issues. Respondents noted that this informer charter fishing, basically unlicensed, unregistered charter fishing boats, basically the Ubers of the waterways, threaten first off the financial ability. It's akin to almost like Uber drivers and taxi drivers. Second, it threatens consumer safety. You know, in the case of Uber, your car breaks down, you can get out and walk, or maybe call a cab or a bus or something. If this happens on the water, it's very different. If you don't have personal flotation suits, if you don't have things that right you if you're knocked unconscious, if you don't have fire extinguishers, if you don't have axes, it's a very different present danger. Also insurance-related matters. And thirdly, of course, is influences fisheries protections of our waters, because we don't know what our catch rates are, how it's impacting different fish species or water species. And one of the unique findings of this project is that it's unlikely that such activities share similarities with the economically disadvantaged populations that have been a characteristic of Uber and many other on-demand services. In this regard, basically the Uber of the waterways are not, they're investing a lot of money, you know, $100,000 boats, big trucks, trailers, so it's a very different group that I think bears more research, and the first piece that's coming out of this is going to be in Labor, Capital, and Society later this year. And one of the big other surprising things is that there has not been as much resistance, unlike the case of Uber and taxis as well. And that's all.
Okay.
If anybody don't gets the reference, Avengers. So thank you to all of you for listening.
Thank you. Thanks, Carlo. And Lewin, you aim to go up next. So Lewin will speak on the theme of... Or you can... I had you on the list next, Lynn. So, migration, citizenship, and work.
Thank you. this helps out, let me just say that I'm really delighted to have this invitation, so thank you, Lupin, and other GLRC folks. And I just wanted to really show you one slide, which is why I'm doing this, but so for a while I was concerned that I wouldn't have anything to say, you know, for 10 minutes, and now I'm afraid I have too much to say. So you can just stop at some point. You had asked us to talk about our own research, so I am. And I have to say that these days I'm really interested in this intersection between migration work and citizenship because I see these intersections, you know, in a way that's very dynamic. Migration across borders certainly troubles ideas of citizenship and belonging. Also troubles ideas about who has access to work and what kind of work and under what conditions. Of course, there's a, you know, these are sort of three spheres that overlap in different ways and not in fixed and static ways. So it's useful to think about these things, and since most of us have to sell our labor power in one way or another, whether we think of ourselves as migrants or not, we have to think about citizenship and work, at least, and what citizenship as an institution does as it includes us, maybe, and excludes others. So there's plenty of work to do here. Before working on research on these areas, I worked on pieces of this. I worked on migration from Mexico to the U.S. I worked on work, but I didn't really put these three general buckets together until my colleague Patricia Landolt and I got a SHRC project called Immigrants and in the New Economy. And this was a three-year project that some of you may be familiar with and may have seen some work from, but I'm going to talk about some key concepts that came out of that work. That project involved face-to-face surveys with 300 people from Latin America and the Caribbean. We were really focused on work and employment precarity. We weren't really running around looking for people without status or with temporary status situations. That wasn't a criteria for the survey. But lo and behold, about nearly half of the people that we talked to, that we and our research team talked to, had arrived in Canada without permanent work authorization and without permanent residence. And so that real, and then by the time of the survey, things had shifted a little bit in terms of, that was their entrance category. At the time of the survey, things had shifted a little bit, and 73% had permanent residence, as opposed to the 38% who had arrived with permanent residence. So that really got us thinking about legal status dynamics and how they change over time, and what the relationship is between legal status and work. And by legal status, I really should be saying socio-legal status all the time. I don't mean authorized status, I mean the juridical, sociolegal side of one's status. And of course, I'm not just talking about status, I'm talking about a whole set of social relations. It just is a shorthand to say legal status. So out of that work, we developed an index of precarious work. I'm sort of reviewing a few things that came out of that project. Conceptual, methodological, empirical things that came out of it. One was this index of precarious work. And it was interesting to us because we asked questions about cash payment. And that was something that was not available in existing databases. So we couldn't just look to the labor force survey, or we couldn't look at the census and get that information. We We also couldn't get information on entrance status in those databases, which is why we went to the enormous trouble of doing this original data collection. So that index, we constructed it at various points in time for people before they came to Canada, sort of a composite of their previous work when they first got to Canada and at the time of the survey. And that allowed us to track changes in the quality of employment as measured by this index alongside changes in their legal status. And that's what led to some of the work that you may or may not be familiar with that looks at the long-term negative, in a sense, or precarious consequences, the long-term precarity of having arrived with not permanent residence. So that even people who were able to move to secure status, to the security of permanent residence, looked more like people who had stayed in some form of precarious status. And that really got us thinking. That also informed work that I did with a group of other researchers on the poverty and employment precarity in Southwestern Ontario project that some of you may know about, directed by Wayne Luchak. And you know, we kind of put something in there about the cash payment and were able to integrate some of these concerns, although the sample for that project is a different topic, which I can talk about later. This project also led to some conceptual work around this notion of precarious legal status. And, you know, if I ask you what precarious legal status is, what would you say? Anybody?
Insecure, unstable.
Insecure, unstable. So changeable, dynamic, somehow not quite the more secure situation that we tend to associate with citizenship. We were really trying to suggest that we should think conceptually about a whole range of different statuses under this one, formal statuses, distinctions, under one conceptual umbrella because of the insecurity and because we found that people moved around. You know, it just was not enough, at least, you know, what we found was that people might have arrived in one situation, maybe as a visitor, maybe as a refugee claimant. They might then end up in another situation. They may try different applications, right? So this this range of legal status precarity involved more than one formal category and involved work done by them, by migrants, refugees, people on the move, by people who were in some cases trying to become more secure or who might be illegalized by the practices of employers, landlords, various other people. So that really got us thinking about immigration policy. Sorry, I'm just going to. About immigration policy and legal status trajectories in a more dynamic way. You know, this thing could be updated as the government comes up with new policies and categories. Some of the boxes change. But the idea that people come in through a particular doorway and then may have these kind of complicated trajectories looks like a descriptive piece of work, but in fact, I would argue that it's really more conceptual and that it involves a different way of understanding policy trajectories, pathways, and the work of multiple actors and institutions in generating these sort of indeterminate, temporally indeterminate, directionally indeterminate pathways. And of course, with the rise of temporary worker entries of various sorts, this has become more complicated. It becomes less easy to just dismiss this as, oh, you know, there's a few people that come in under temporary programs or that might come in other ways and they have these kind of complicated situations. In fact, we can look at work done by people in this room, John Carlaw, Adrian, Other people, Philip Kelly, you know, who, Leah, you know, other people who really talk about the institutionalized production of complicated legal status pathways. And so that has been occupying my mind still in a couple of ways. One is by informing the current research that a new Shirk-funded project that Patricia and I are involved with that involves an online survey of people who are arrived not as permanent residents. So we figured the PEPSA project talked to citizens and permanent residents. We really wanted to focus on the experiences of people that arrive not as permanent residents. So we have about 1,200 and counting responses to this online survey right now. And it's been a bit of a challenge, as usual, with this kind of work. And Ives has helped us, you know, get some Brazilian respondents. We hired a bunch of people who were also involved in helping us recruit in particular communities. And while the statisticians in the room will remind me that it's not a random sample, I will counter that there is no sampling frame. And so it is not something that one might use for the kind of statistical analysis that we might love to have, but it will certainly allow us to identify some legal status trajectories and pathways and to consider the relationship between employment quality and these pathways. Since I have 1 minute, I will say that this kind of research, I think, helps us think about methodological nationalism in different ways. Some of you are familiar with the term, and here I would invite you to think about it in terms of the picture of the nation that our official data present. So we have the census, we have the labor force service, we have the survey. We have these various things that really look at the population that is formally recognized and understood to be part of the population. But people at this, some of these databases include temporary workers. They don't include everybody. And so they present a picture of the nation that is somewhat incomplete. And so I think that's another way to think about the methodological nationalism involved in those databases. And our research, I think, can help to nudge that a little bit and question that a little bit. 1 minute?
Sure.
Sure. let me just close by saying that I think, you know, if I kind of step back and think about, well, what have I really been doing all these years? There's a concern with boundaries and how boundaries are drawn institutionally, how they're resisted, questioned, negotiated, transgressed, and to think about the distinction between formal boundaries, like citizenship, and other kinds of boundaries, and how these connect to differential inclusion.
Thanks very much, Lewin. Adrian,
great.
Are you up next? Adrian is going to focus on revitalization of workers' movements, or something like that.
In 10 minutes.
In 10 minutes.
thank you. So, maybe I'll start where Lewin ended off, because I found that very compelling in terms of my own intellectual agenda and the sort of idea of thinking about how boundaries are drawn institutionally and investigating that. I remember when I was in law school many years ago, and I just didn't understand it. I just couldn't understand law school. So the problem I had, right, is that in a law school classroom, you spent all of this time, you know, to use the sort of maybe now overdrawn kind of distinction, you spent all of this time on law in the books, and you don't think about law in action, right? So I just couldn't understand it, right? So you sit in these law school classrooms, and you and it's very intellectually compelling and seductive, the sort of engagements you go through, thinking through rules and so on. But I didn't understand it in the sense of people's ordinary lives, right? Working lives especially. And so when I became a student at Parkdale, a caseworker student, so Parkdale is a kind of a, you know, a placement for students that you do a full term, full-time placement where you are working in the poverty law context. I was in the workers' rights division, and you're seeing precarious workers taking it every day, right? Dealing with all of this kind of stuff. And you know, it's right in your face, the idea that that enforcement and collections is the game, and workers are always losing that game, right? It's a never-ending struggle where even when a worker wins at a specific tribunal, they have an employment standards claim, they go in front of an employment standards officer, the employment standards officer finds in their favor, you know, the employer's disappeared, and you can't collect the money, and so there's all of these problems of collection enforcement, which we never talk about in the law school classroom proper. So for me, that's helped me draw. So I left Parkdale just kind of perplexed by that, and so all of my career has been since then trying to sort that out in my head. Why do we care so much about law and the way we talk about it in law schools, in the orthodox sense at least? Some exceptions certainly can be found. My colleague Amar Bhatia would be one of them, and there were others who talk about it in a more critical way, but we talk about it in an orthodox way, law on the books, but we don't really talk about it in action. So that's really been sort of the heart of some of the work I've been doing, and in many respects trying to think through the elitist and technocratic construction of law in the context of knowledge production, and then wondering how social movements can get around that. Because even though social movement, and I'm talking here about sort of progressivist, leftist social movements, right? And that's a kind of on a continuum, if you will. Even though social movements are attempting to get around that, they still are also seduced by the idea of law at the end of the day, the sort of orthodox understanding of law at certain times. Now, again, there are folks that have showed us, and I think there are some, Leslie Wood's work, for example, Irina Sirik's work, have shown us that social movements have and can think differently about law, about policing, and so on, and I think that's important for us to see. So I've been sort of captured by all of those kinds of folks and been caught up doing that work myself, and so what I see myself doing then is just operating at a different level of abstraction. When I'm thinking about law and its relationship to workers and the regulation of work and labor. But of course, you can never get outside of law, right? Especially secular capitalist law. Okay? And so that's the conundrum that I think we ultimately have. So let me try to, that's what I've tried to work on at least. So what does that mean for the revitalization of workers' movements? I don't know. But that's what I'm trying to think through. And so I focused really specifically at times on racialized foreign workers, right? The racialized other, foreign other, and taken a sort of a close look at migrant farm workers and worked in sort of with folks organizing migrant farm workers and so on. What I actually want to do right now is draw back again and just try to make a more broader claim here and point out. And again, I don't know if this is systematic at all. In fact, in my brain, it's very mushy. But I'm going to point out some areas where we can see similar kinds of things operating in the context of what I want to call a foreignness. There's this kind of commodity, radical sort of Marxist folks will talk about security as a commodity and how the commodity of security interpenetrates other commodities, including labor. And And I want to say here that foreignness as a concept is an extension of the security commodity, and it's operating and it's moving. And I think we would do well in labor studies if we followed that movement. And so I want to cross through some different areas to think through that. This comes out of some work that I did. Again, there's a new journal called TWAILR. TWAILR is called Third World Approaches to International Law. It's kind of a movement within legal circles, somewhat critical, sometimes even radical, which is attempting to interject notions of the global south and colonialism within our understandings of international law. And I did something very recently in a burgeoning journal called TWAILR, which Omar Batiat is also on the editorial board for, about the commodification of labor and how the ILO's, this is 75th anniversary of the ILO's claim, principled kind of position that labor is not a commodity, but everywhere we look, I say, labor is commodified. So how do we reconcile that gap? So I've written about this in this TWAILR piece. And so as thinking through this, and thinking through specifically the idea of migrant labor in this, and food workers more broadly, it's had me realize that foreignness is an essential part of or feature of the commodification that we see. And we can see it operating both in, not just as commodification and the process of commodification, we can also see foreignness operating in terms of dispossession, exploitation, what anti-security folks call pacification. And so the adjustment I make to that anti-security intervention, which I think is an important one, is to say that pacification is, which they would define as the maintenance of a social order, the maintenance of a capitalist order. I would revise that to say it's the maintenance of a settler capitalist order in the context of Canada, where we can see a labor being produced, productive labor being produced, and now here my intervention is that foreignness is central to the production of migrant labor, and all labor, in fact. And so, to me, if you take anything from this talk, it's that we have to start digging in even more deeply on the fact that foreignness is central to the way that all labor is articulated or produced in our societies. And I think there are different ways we can see this happening. So, let me throw out some examples. The one that's been really playing in my head, and I'm glad Steve Tufts is here. He just wrote a really great sort of opinion piece on public pension funds in the Toronto Star in the last couple of weeks, is the idea that is the kind of tension that we see within our public pension funds. Of course, this is not a new phenomenon. We've been seeing this for the last 3 decades, I think, if not longer. Where we've seen this sort of Canadian model of pensions going out into the beyond Canada and in effect engaging in a colonization or imperialist kind of project. And I think it's important that we see that it implicitly at least operates on derives benefit from the distinction between domestic and foreign. Okay. 1 minute already? That's great, because I'm just going to go through these quickly. And so the public pension funds, Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, has its offices in Manhattan, Hong Kong, Brazil. It's gone from 5 employees in 2000 to 1,600 employees, working in 5 different continents in 7 time zones. Quite importantly, and here I want to juxtapose what the public pensions are doing with the Unifor's campaign, the sort of Boycott Mexico campaign, we can see CPPIB operating to own the toll road, the Arco Norte toll road in just the northern Mexico City. And at the same time, we can see back home Unifor saying we need to boycott the production of Mexican vehicles. There's a tension here. I think both are operating on this domestic-foreign kind of distinction. We also see it in the housing shortages within BC, within Ontario. Like, again, where the foreign boogeyman is invoked. And I think it's pushing us away from talking more forcefully about the idea of housing markets in itself and how they're perpetually constructed in a very problematic way. And I think actually CCPA has pointed out really nicely about the rental wage and that's the impact on workers. The pipeline debate, another example. And especially here we could think about this sort of anti-Alberta foreign interest kind of intervention that we've seen in Alberta, where they've had this public inquiry that's been struck to look at the foreign interests, and again operating on this idea that that the foreign interests are undermining the Alberta's economy. My point here then is just simply that that foreignness is acting as a shroud, as a kind of cover for the capital accumulation to continue, and that's the point that I'd like to make. I realize I gave too much setup at the beginning, and so I'm out of time, but really what I want to say is I think there are lots of ways in which we could start to think more broadly about the way foreignness is operating as a cover for capital accumulation. And so some of the work I've been trying to do, and I hope others are picking up on, is just the idea that we could dig into this and think a little bit more critically, especially in the context when we see that foreignness is not just a general claim, it's a very specific claim, it's a racialized claim. And then so we can see that the racialized politics of foreignness is something that needs to be taken up as we think about revitalizing.
Thanks very much. And Pat?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, exactly. Okay. Thank you.
I'll make sure I don't take more. Thank you for giving me the space to speak and this impressive group of people. Yeah, it's truly a pleasure, actually, and I'm delighted to see the center doing so well. I was involved in setting this one up and the thing that preceded it, partly because I'm old, and I was wondering where Carlo put me on his trajectory there at the beginning. Don't tell me, Carlo. I first met Carlo when he was a student, actually. My research in health services grows directly out of two major interests. One is in working with others for fundamental change, and the other is women's work. Feminist political economy, understood as a work in progress always, guides the research. And most of it's done in collaboration with unions and community organizations, or even as in the case with our most recent project, with a couple of nonprofit employers' organizations. In terms of organizing for change, healthcare offers an opportunity to demonstrate the collective nonprofit provision based on a notion of shared responsibility and risk, as well as on a different notion of ways to organize work, and that can be a way forward. It's a demonstration project, I think, as long as it works. And actually, there was a conference 20 years ago where the government was told that the worst problem for them in terms of healthcare was its popularity. And I think we have to remember that as we go forward. They're doing a pretty good job of making it unpopular, but I still think that it's a way of demonstrating how that can work. Healthcare is also where women account for 80% of the paid and unpaid labor force, and where nearly a quarter of the women with paid jobs find employment. A third of the healthcare labor force, it has been born outside the country, according to the latest data. And of course, the numbers are much larger in major urban centers like Toronto. I started with hospitals in part because our daughter broke her leg, and when we got to the hospital, her father and I, they said to the mother, this is where you can empty the bedpans and get her something to eat and change her sheets. And I realized there was something happening in the healthcare sector, but also that this was an incredible microcosm of women's work. There's everything that women do here in this one kind of workplace. And I moved on from that to home care, and from that to focusing on nursing homes, and Hugh says it's because of self-interest that we're working at nursing homes these days. But that's not to suggest that the work in any of those sectors is complete, but that rather one pushed us in to look at the other. Our methods are feminist in at least three ways. First, the research process is collective as well as democratic, with data and ideas constantly shared and challenged. Second, it's focused, as Dorothy Smith, among many others, tell us to do, on listening to and observing those who live, work, and visit in nursing homes. That's one of the reasons we wrote a book on clothes and laundry, by the way, because of what they told us. Third, we struggle to make the invisible visible, especially when it comes to power, the search for profit, skills, and social relations, as well as to link with paid and unpaid work. We are working in this project to shift the discourse, arguing that you cannot have person-centered care, which is all the buzz terminology in care right now, without understanding that the conditions of work are the conditions of care, and that the health of the healthcare workers is central to the health of those who need care. These include the shift to for-profit ownership that Carla was talking about, and the adoption of for-profit managerial strategies within the public sector that remains. The business of government has become business, as Moroni liked to say. Paid work has become even more precarious, with irregular shifts, multiple workplaces, more part-time and more overtime, or even double shifts within the healthcare sector, and especially within the nursing home sector. There is, as a result, less continuity in care, less teamwork. It's much harder to get to know your colleagues and to get to work with them effectively. Workloads have increased both as a result of new managerial strategies and of admission practices that ensure only those with very high needs get into long-term care, pushing others into the for-profit sector where the right to buy becomes the right to care. The work is even more task-focused and monitored, disempowering workers and making it even more difficult for workers to respond to individual needs or to apply their skills. As a result, violence increases and workers go home exhausted and feeling guilty. As Donna Baines makes clear in her research, employers rely on women's altruism to fill the gaps in care. This is the case not only with paid workers, she talks about, but also for the women family members and volunteers who regularly help residents eat, do laundry, provide entertainment, exercise, and social support. It's interesting in our project that involves six countries, when we were talking about volunteers, our Swedish partner said, "We have no volunteers in our system," and we didn't see any when we did our research there. Now, there is, of course, resistance to these processes, and our research has identified many of them and tried to support many of them. But some of them are also contradictory, as in the case with the especially women workers trying to fill the gaps in care by working overtime, working through their lunch, coming in early, staying late. And they understand that as a form of resistance, which it is, resistance to bad care. It's also full of tensions, and of course, our feminist political economy teaches us to look for contradictions and tensions. As in the case, for instance, when each group of workers works to carve out a space for their own particular area of skills, that in fact, and especially in the case of say, RNs who have wanted to shed all of the stuff associated with women's work so that they could be professionals onto another group of workers who are defined as unskilled. As a result. But some of this resistance has been very effective, as a case, for instance, in a place we were in, a small town in Ontario, where the workers, the unions, worked with the boards of the hospital and the nursing home, as well as some community groups, to effectively kick out Sodexo that had privatized the food services and to bring the food services back in-house. And one of the groups that we've had some connections with in Norway, the Campaign for the Welfare State, has in fact been able to reverse the for-profit ownership in nursing homes in Norway. Now, because Fran is not here today, and I was asked to take up another 5 minutes by talking more specifically about gender, I thought I would talk about pay equity in particular, because I have worked with Fran on pay equity, and I think this is an example of a place where academics can do their academic work and have it have a non-academic impact in the sense of being a factor in change. Pay equity, a legislation that was brought into Ontario and in fact across Canada, and it's new legislation at the federal level, was built on academic research and, of course, on union struggles. As Buzz Hargrove used to say, it's not just the power of your argument, the power behind your argument. Both of those worked in the case of bringing in the pay equity legislation and in a more minority government in terms of Ontario. And that pay equity legislation, so first of all, there was academic work involved in bringing it into legislation. And then it was in the case of bringing it into practice. There was academics have been fundamentally central to the research that has been used to implement the Pay Equity Act in Ontario and in other provinces in Canada, as well as, of course, in other places in the world. And Ontario has been used as an example in many of those cases. Now, of course, pay equity has worked for everyone, but it has resulted in some really fundamental wage gains for women, but also for some fundamental gains in terms of talking about the skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions involved in traditional women's work, because the research showed that the labor force was not only divided into male and female jobs, but that the female jobs were given a much lower value than the male jobs. And pay equity, as I'm sure you know, is that comparison between jobs and not between people of the sort you get with equal pay for equal work. So it's a job question, and it takes it to the structural factors that we heard about earlier when we're talking about making change. Now, of course, at the same time, there are lots of things pay equity doesn't do, and Faye has been working with a national group in Canada to try and have an impact at the federal level on the new legislation and to bring it into practice, because she co-chairs the Pay Equity Committee coalition in Ontario that brings together unions and community groups, to extend these to Indigenous people, to people with disabilities, to racialized people in terms of pay, because pay equity now is focused on gender. I will mention one other case that comes out of law, to go back to what we were just hearing about law, was a midwife's case that was just heard in front of the Human Rights Commission in Ontario. Had to be heard in front of Human Rights because midwives are non-employees, they're contract workers, and pay equity only applies to employees. So it was taken to the Human Rights Commission to argue that it was an employer-employee relationship going back to the gig economy. And they won. They won in terms of the initial decision, at least, to say that it was an employee relationship and they were being underpaid relative to doctors. Now, Faye also has been working in terms of minimum wages, because minimum wages, of course, the majority of people who work on minimum wage are women. Many of them racialized and or immigrant women, or Indigenous women, women with disabilities. And we see that they also work around violence. We did a survey of workers in nursing homes in Ontario and the Nordic countries, and the workers in Canada indicated that they were 7 times as likely to face violence on a daily basis as the Nordic countries. And I think that we can understand that difference in terms of the conditions of work and the relations of work. So don't mourn, organize.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I invite you back to the front. We have 10 or 15 minutes for some discussion. I had suggested that we talk about this question that perplexes me and I have some angst about what are we doing here in the university? What is to address some of these issues? That it's a rather bleak picture, feels to me like getting bleaker all the time. Part of this is my own agenda, or it is my own agenda, because a few years ago when my son was just beginning his master's at McGill in ecological economics, he said to me, his main concern was that he didn't want to become a useless academic. I thought, okay, well, there you go. Useless academic. So how, and also, I mean, some of the new things that are coming out from the province around the metrics for measuring the success of our work, which has little to do with anything that I think I do in a day-to-day, my day-to-day work. So some of you have already reflected on this in your talks about how do we, as researchers and educators, influence the direction of change in labor markets and the economy to think differently about work, livelihoods, and also, how do we encourage in our students? I think about this particularly, I teach in social work. How do we encourage students to think differently and instead of seeing themselves as victims of an unfair job market, how do we help them to think about themselves as leaders and give them the skills that they need? So I invite you to take, just say whatever you wish about that, then we will also open it up to the audience to ask their questions. Pat?
I was going to say something very quickly that I was going to end with, but don't warn organizers, such a better line, is that I think the other thing that is very important is that we have to make our work accessible.
Yeah.
And in our project, we have produced these four small books that we give out for free, and we can produce them for less than it costs to pay to publish an article in a open access journal, and they go like.
Maybe I can say something on this point that actually Pat and I were just speaking about it briefly earlier. I mean, one of the decisions I made very early on in my career was perhaps out of some vanity, maybe, but out of a broader interest in some political mobilizational efforts. Was that any academic, scholarly piece of writing that I would do, I would try to generalize it in the sense that it could be mobilized for knowledge, to use the parlance of Shirk. So I started writing an op-ed for every formal academic article in the span of the last 4 or 5 years. I would say that a good majority of them ended up coming out one and one. And it's through those op-eds and op-ed pieces and kind of extending into some, I did a little thing on TVO, and I'm not trying to gloat or anything. I hate when I talk about things like that, it makes me very uncomfortable. But it wasn't because they read anything scholarly. It's because she read a Huffington Post piece I wrote and saw a YouTube video of me talking about these urban issues. And the only reason I mention it because I think, unlike the right in some cases, which have these very well-funded think tanks that are well-heeled and dispersed, you know, I was speaking with some colleagues in the department. I was invited to do something on air or on radio or something, and I just couldn't do it because I was getting overwhelmed. And I had suggested two or three colleagues in my department, and all of them said no. So after I asked them, you know, why did you say no? This is a great opportunity to talk about all the amazing work you're doing, and it's a great opportunity to get some of your ideas out there. And some of it is this I think that's a general idea that we're always unsure that we know enough to be speaking as experts in the area. And I think so. In doing so, sometimes we cede that ground to right-wing arguments, which are, you know, they have their own training schools and they do these kinds of things. But part of the blame lies in ourselves is not creating the infrastructure of having these kinds of rapid responses where we're able to engage because we're so, you know, oftentimes just technocratic writing for these things. So I think the initiative that Pat's discussing and through these various fora can really, you know, result in unexpected ways of connecting with generalizing our research.
Mm-hmm. and you have a piece, an opinion piece in the Huffington Post just published a couple days ago.
Yeah, that was interesting because that actually wasn't about, it was about low-wage work, but I think this is an aside, but the editor of that piece actually changed it. So the title was, they asked me to tie it to the election and they said, can you discuss low-wage workers? And so the title of the piece was something like, what to do about Canada's low-wage workforce. And they changed it to something like, why you need to organize a union in your workplace, which of course unleashed the trolls. Right? and I got to like emails, but at least people are talking about it, yeah. I guess, right?
Okay.
But interestingly enough, interesting. Thank you for mentioning that.
Adrian?
Yeah, I mean, and I think Carlo's been great at this kind of thing. And I think Pat also has an example, a model that I really appreciate, which is working with grad students and publishing with grad students, bringing them into projects and so on. And, you know, what I really like about it is not just kind of supporting a specific individual grad student, but it also decenters academics. Like, you know, the one thing that I've struggled with as an academic, especially in the last little while, is that students are looking to me to solve all of the problems that exist in a neoliberal institution that I myself am struggling to exist in, right? Mm-hmm. Especially not just as I'm very privileged in this institution, so don't get me wrong, but there are, you know, as a racialized faculty member in this institution, you know, one that has to deal with colleagues who say stuff like, we shouldn't be hiring equity candidates, we should be looking for people with substance, right? They make these kinds of claims anonymously. I find myself in a kind of a difficult position where I'm trying to, find sort of, my own space. So, I really like the model of kind of let's kind of support students and all of the men and all of their sort of incarnations and help to elevate them as well and not just have it like, oh, we're academics, we're going to solve the problems. Because that, to me, just reinforces the kind of hierarchical conceptions of knowledge production that actually I want to resist in the first place.
Right.
Lewin,
do you
want to
add any?
Well, I would echo what's been said. I think there's also the question of the groups and organizations that we work with, and Pat, you've touched on it. I mean, all of you have touched on it. But that can take many different forms, right? It can be more officially community-based research. It may be consulting. It may take different forms, right? But it's a question of widening the circle of knowledge production, students, but people outside of academia as well. And, I don't think I have to tell this crowd that there's also a question of sustained long-term presence and cultivating and maintaining these relationships in meaningful ways so that we don't get accused of the parachuting, dropping in, and exiting academics, which, I think many of us show up at an organization and one of the first questions were asked is, and what are you going to do with this, and how long are you going to be around if people don't know us? But I think it's very heartening in a way to see that the kind of work that a lot of people in this room have been involved with or are involved with is having an impact outside of academia.
Right.
That whether it's going to change policies, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think if we think of research as part of the advocacy and campaigning and organizing process, then, I could go through each, there are a bunch of people in this room that are involved in these things. And I think that's important. And I think it does change to contribute to changing the language that we use.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing in ideas about settler colonial legacies, talking about race and racialization and foreignness or intersections in our classrooms, in our teaching, in our work with students,
You know, people change the way, I'm saying something very obvious, but people change the way they see things, and they might go and talk to somebody else. And I think that is as important as the media and all the other channels we use. I think it's really just a multi-channel strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm finding opportunities on this subject.
Yeah, that too.
When you listen into other people's conversations about privatization and interviewing.